Hi, I'm Wendy, and this is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Wendy Garrick. Thanks for joining me today. And if you want to follow along online, you can also do that through the blog sites at talkingtonightlife.com or consciousforlife.blogspot. Today's guest, I've actually talked to before. It's been a while. Choices and Illusions was the book that I got that first gave me an idea of what Eldon Taylor was about, and I really appreciate his ability to address the things that we all deal with in terms of what is reality and how we are creating our reality. And he's since gone on to doing his own show now, and he also has more books out. And if you haven't had a chance, check out his website. It's eldontaylor.com. You can find out all sorts of information there. And also, he's got some great free programs you can check out, too. Hi, Eldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, Wendy. How about yourself?
Great. Thank you. I'm so glad I'm getting to talk to you because you are a busy guy.
Have been recently. You're absolutely right.
Okay, so what is the newest of all of the things that you've got out? Choices and Illusions, that, like I said, that's where I started. But I know you've done a whole lot of work with mind programming. And what's the current project?
Well, you know, Choices and Illusions was actually number 12 in the books that I've written. But it was also the first to make the New York Times. And, you know, that triggered off a real change, if you will, in direction, as opposed to writing a book every 4 or 5 years. I found myself writing one every year. The most recent is the book, What If? But you're right, mind programming also hit the New York Times, and I still spend a lot of time talking about that book. Indeed, last night, it was a main show in Australia that I was doing at midnight, all about mind programming. I think the reason is because it underlies or is a foundation for understanding how it is that we have all become so much less than what we are. Why it is that we are living in a state or a condition of self-alienation and ignorant to it. Indeed, most people who might think of mind programming are quick to dismiss it as, well, that's something that may affect some, but it certainly doesn't affect me. I'm in charge of my thoughts. I make my own decisions. I know what I would do. I know how I would handle things. And forgive me, I don't mean this as any insult, but those that step forward with that argument are typically the most indoctrinated of all.
Well, I think that's because there's this general assumption that when somebody does it, you will be able to identify it. People forget that from the time that they're born, they are being programmed into whatever society roles, whatever cultural roles, all of that stuff. The moment the body is out, and genetically that's another sort of programming, but that's already happening. And we really have to consciously connect to that to rework it, reroute it, and it's just part of being human that you have to identify that and then somehow find a way that works for you to get around the programming. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and you know, that is precisely why I wrote the book, my latest, What If? You know, you can go through all of the information and explain how it is that we're all inculcated, socialized, enculturated, programmed, whatever you're comfortable with, into selecting between a given set of choices as opposed to seeing all the alternatives. Why it is that we have the implicit assumptions that we have that cause us to see a Susan Boyle, UK's Got Talent, and laugh at her because she's a disheveled housekeeper in, a circa 1950s house dress? But when she opens her mouth and we hear this most mellifluous sound, then we're puzzled. We're puzzled because we don't understand how a singer can look like that. Well, where do we ever get the idea that singers should look like anything? People are blind to this self-imposed information limit, and you can tell them all about it, and you can give them, you know, some easy ways to explore their own inner beliefs. But again, I'm going to come back and say, Wendy, most people will refuse to accept that that's true of them. You know, Philip Zimbardo, past president of the American Psychological Association, has identified something that we just think of as the Lucifer effect today. And study after study, whether it's, you know, the work of Milgram in delivering electric shock, or the Stanford Prison Experiment, or the social identity theories, you know, that made Lord of the Flies so popular, all of this research shows us over and over that as human beings, we are apt to do what we say we will not do. We are, you know, we are creatures that fail ourselves because of limitations that are imposed upon us by ourselves that have to do with the way we see the world, the definitions that we have, what we see as responsibility, various compliance principles. And in that way, we have really become what it was that Edward Bernays wanted us to become when he wrote in his book, Propaganda, it is the responsibility of the elite to orchestrate the thoughts of the masses in order to march a cohesive society in any direction. So we have really become all of those things. And so what I wanted to do in What If was, instead of talk about a theoretical, instead of give you examples of various subliminal means that are used to manipulate you, or supraliminal, or compliance principles, instead of talk about all of that technology and history, what I wanted to do was get inside you. And so I, you know, the book is all about 22 thought experiments. That when you participate in the thought experiment, you actually turn yourself inside out on what your own beliefs are. And what I find is you either love the book because it exposes aspects of yourself that you're not aware of. I mean, most of us believe something that is mutually exclusive to something else we also believe. That's called dissonance. Or you're going to hate me because I'm going to push buttons and you're going to hate the book. In fact, if you look at the reviews at Amazon, the preponderance of them are 5-star. But if they're not 5-star, they're 1-star. There's no in-between.
Well, that means it's an emotional response one way or the other.
It is, and it was designed to be. But, you know, everybody says, you know, I hear everyone nowadays say, you know, I just don't know who I am anymore. I'm so busy with my job, parenting, finances, my home, and everything that's going on. There's so much information out there. You know, I've lost myself some time ago, and I just, you know, if you haven't said that, but you think about it seriously for a minute, that very first question, who am I, is the last one that we tend to ask in our lifetimes. And yet it's the most important. You know, Robert Lang said in his wonderful book, Politics of Experience, the condition of the normal man is a condition of alienation, and we highly prize the normal man, so we educate our children to become alienated and thus normal and therefore absurd. And you know, that statement is very, very true today. We go out into the world with ideas and beliefs that are nothing more than sound bites. You know, one of the things that I do, Wendy, is I look at words that work, if you will. And so I'll watch media pretty closely. And every morning when I'm dressing, I'll watch, you know, the different news networks. And we have quite a disparity in our news. I mean, we have a very, very liberal and a very, very conservative network that is available on satellite. And so I'll juxtapose those often. Now, this is what I mean by soundbite thinking. Recently, there was a poll being conducted on both of these networks at the same time, but it was essentially the same poll. It was just framed differently. The poll went like this on one network: should poor taxpayers be asked to pay, reimburse rich parents who put their children in private school? On the next network, the question was, survey, should poor parents be asked to pay twice for their children's education because our public education system is failing, and they often work two jobs in order to put their children into private schools? Now, it's the same question. You know, this is about school vouchers. But if I got my context out of poor parents paying for rich kids, I absolutely oppose it. But if I got my context out of poor parents paying double, once for a failing public school system and then again for a private school, well, then I'm for it. And you see, the problem is I don't stop and do my own research. I don't, okay, what is the deal with school vouchers? Where does the money come from? Has it been... have they been used anywhere? What impact would this have on the public school? Would it increase the education level? I don't do the research to have any intelligence about it, any intelligence about the subject. I instead opt for that soundbite. Now, if you think about soundbites and you think, you know, you might, you know, look at this and say, well, so what? Well, here's a good one. And you know, let's do this one together. I want you to think about the saliva in your mouth, Wendy. I want you to roll it around. I want you to taste it. I want your audience to do this with us. And I want you to recognize that you're glad you have it. Mine tastes good. You know, some people say, well, mine doesn't taste. But you're glad you have it, nevertheless. So this is the saliva in my mouth. Thank you. I'm very happy I have it. Now I want you to imagine that you have a little shot glass, the kind that, you know, if you went into a saloon of some sort or another, you would get if you had a straight shot of bourbon. So you have this little shot glass in front of you, and I want you to spit some of that saliva into that shot glass. Take a look at it, maybe tip the glass a little, see if there's any air bubbles in it, and then I want you to drink it back. Now, if you're like 99.9% of the population, the minute I said drink it back, you went, oh, that's vile. But you see, it's the same saliva that was in my mouth. A saliva in my mouth becomes a spit in the glass, and it's great in my mouth. In that context, I love it. But in that glass, the idea of thinking it, even though, or drinking it, even though it's separated from my mouth by seconds, is vile. Now, why is that?
Well, yeah, the backwash factor.
It's that context framing again, you know, and it propels our thinking, it propels our emotions. It absolutely underlies the nature of our experiences, our beliefs in the world. So if we have a context that has framed us, and then we begin to make our decisions on the basis of those context frames, these definitions and these sound bites, how can we say that we have the slightest clue about who we are? And yet lots of folks are going around, you know, I'm enlightened. I read a book. And I find that, I find that very disappointing when you realize the human potential, the absolutely awesome human potential for the vast majority of people to be existing the way they do is just tremendously disappointing.
Okay, my question is then, because we can analyze this, we can go through and just really nitpick all of the reasons why they shouldn't. But there's another thing that goes beyond that. When our own programming, our own desire kind of interferes with what we know might be in our best interest. One of the things that really challenges people is some of this stuff requires us to think outside the norm, the box, the status quo. And anytime someone tries to shift or question or go around the status quo, then they've got six people ready to kick them right back into that lockstep of this is the way we do it here. And whether it's Russia, America, South America, Asia, it's each culture, each place has its status quo. And those who are considered deviants or people who are rebels, they may be just beyond the curve and so far into the future with their thinking that nobody else gets it. And because of that, they say, you don't fit, you don't belong. And that person, if they don't have a very strong sense of self-awareness, they're going to say, oh, you're right. Okay, I want to be like you. And the programming in our own nature is to be part of a group, to become one and bond with our group. How do we get around that?
Well, you're right. We are social animals, and we do respond to peer pressure. One of our problems is because of that, we actually rehearse at very early ages a false self. We copy it, mimic it, imitate it, whatever you would like, out of our environment. It might be an icon we see on television, and so we might, as a young man, be standing in front of the mirror, making our finger and thumb look like a gun, saying, go ahead and make my day, you know? We do rehearse our roles, and, it's not at all uncommon. In fact, it is in the majority of instances, we see people put on a set of clothes. I live in Spokane, Washington. I have a horse ranch over here, just a little hobby ranch. If I put on my boots and my chaps, I have to be aware that I'm still Eldon Taylor, because there was a time I could put on my boots, my chaps, my hat, and I was a cowboy, you know, and I talk like a cowboy and I walk like a cowboy. And that was an entirely different me than when I put on a three-piece suit and a tie and I walked into a university to give a presentation. Most people are aware that the way you dress often dictates your behavior. And that's because we have these rehearsed roles. It's not who we really are. It's what we have practiced being. And we have practiced being these things in order to be a part of that herd, in order to fit in order to blend. I mean, after all, who wants somebody in a three-piece suit with a tie who acts like a college professor out back of the rodeo chutes at the national finals in Las Vegas, right? So in order to blend in, I've got to get down. And you see, we do this. Now, in the process of doing this, we not only deny ourselves, but we actually surrender our autonomy. We're saying, you know, it is more important for me to blend than it is for me to be me, whatever that means. Now, those people that you talk about, you know, that are the innovators, that see this, that are, as Lange said in Knots, I see that they're playing a game. But if I let them know that I see that they're playing the game, they won't let me play the game with them. Those people that are truly innovators that step forward and say, hey, this is a game and I'm not going to have any part of it, this is where things ought to go, they don't get to play the game. The people that really are able to make the changes are the ones that see it, Wendy, like you, are aware of it, but they're not compelled to expose it to everyone. Instead, they work at chipping it away a little bit at a time so that the vast majority of people also see it and begin to chip away at it and begin to express their genuine self as opposed to participate like cattle at a precipice.
It's really challenging when you are trying to make those changes. And the initial changes, like what you're talking about, that self-realization, when you have to let go of some things that have been very important in terms of setting up your identity. You know, and as you're saying, being one of the herd, you want to fit in, and you've had all of this support. And I think we're going to have to take a break here in a minute or two. But when that happens, we have to find another support system. What do you advise for people who are just now trying to find ways to, when they realize that their self, their real self may not be what the public self has set up, what's the support system that can get them started to make the rest of those transitional,
Okay, now this may take a couple of minutes. Have we got a couple of minutes? That's what I want to answer.
We'll certainly come after the break. We'll be back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a
bear sighting?
Location.
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
At one second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent
Ranger
wildfires.
Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting?
Location.
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
At one second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
20 years ago, the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. The act was a huge step forward for the 50 million people in this country living with a disability, and the culmination of years of effort by those who marched and spoke up and refused to be treated as second-class citizens. It helped renew the promise that here in America, we're defined not by our limitations, but by our potential. As we celebrate the 20th anniversary of this historic legislation, it's important to remember that we're still fulfilling that promise. We're still working to secure the rights guaranteed by the ADA, the right to live and work without limits, the right to equal justice under the law, and the right of every person in this country to reach for the American dream. We've come a long way since 1990, and I'm committed to making even more progress in the years ahead. Visit disability.gov to see how you can help.
Brought to you by the American Association of People with Disabilities and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio, and we're back with Eldon Taylor. And we were talking about the challenge of self-realization when you figure out who you are and then need to build a support system, because some of the things that you've already set in your life and have already programmed into a foundation and a real nice niche for yourself may not apply once you've figured out, hey, this wasn't really my stuff. This is somebody else's stuff. Hi, Eldon.
Hi.
Okay, and you're ready to tackle that. You want to
dive
in.
All right, and to do this, I'm gonna create a little bit of a thought experiment, just like we do in What If. If you were to wake up tomorrow morning, Wendy, with complete amnesia, total amnesia, you had no idea who you were, anything about yourself, etc., what would be the most important, most pressing question you would have? Who am I, right? I mean,
okay.
There'd be nothing more important than that. Now, if I came to you, Wendy, and I said to you, well, you're Wendy Garrett, you're the host of Conscious Living with Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio, and so on and so forth, would that really mean anything to you any more than
absolutely
if I came to you?
Absolutely not.
Right.
No, those are labels. Yeah.
That's right. It would mean absolutely nothing. All of that information that you come to think of yourself as being would mean nothing to you. How tall you are, what school you went to, the house, your house address, the car you drive, would mean nothing. Whether you owned a Cadillac or an Oldsmobile would mean nothing. So now, if you stop and you think about this for just a minute, very seriously, It exposes two things. The first is we really don't know who we are. And the second is how we think of ourselves is all about the things, the nouns. Now, years ago, there was a famous Greek by the name of Pythagoras. And everybody's heard of him because of his Pythagorean theorem and his work in geometry. But he was also a musician and a mystic. And indeed, he founded a school, a mystical school called the Pythagorean Brotherhood. Now, this was a highly sought-after organization, private club, if you will, to belong to. And there were certain things, certain prerequisites that had to be met in order for you to join. One of those prerequisites was you had to appear before the entire academy and tell them one thing that you knew with an absolute certainty. Here's my epistemological certainty, my one thing that I know with an absolute certainty. You were given all the time that you might need. I mean, you could take years. You could go into the desert and fast. You could do whatever you wanted to do. This was like your final test. And once you appeared before the academy and you laid out your certainty, on cue, they would all begin to criticize, ridicule, laugh, mock, cajole, use the best logic of the time, etc., to dissuade you from what you said you knew for certain. Now, if they were successful at dissuading you, you were not accepted into the academy. The test wasn't so much about the content of what you were saying. It was about the veracity with which you said it. If you step forward and say, I know something for absolute certain, you should know that. And what you should know for absolute certain, for sure, should ought to be about ourselves, shouldn't it? Now, there are lots of people that when I say to them, you know, what would you say if you were called upon? They say things like, well, you know, I'd say I know there's a God. And oh, really? And then the academy would attack you. They would come after you like, okay, well, what is this, a man on a throne? Is it androgynous? Is he all-powerful? If he's all-powerful, can he lift a rock? Can he build a rock so large he can't lift it? Da-da-da. You see, the problem with saying anything is the nature of our definitions, and our words can be wrapped around so that when we're all said and done, we can talk about, as I just said, an omnipotent, omnipowerful, all-powerful God, I should say, and then we can create this little, you know, can he build a rock because he's all-powerful, so large that he can't lift it? These nifty little crafted statements that undermine the very definition we've created. So when we're all said and done, that gets pretty well wiped out. So what would you say? Now, I've shared this with many people, and I'll come back to your answer, but here is what I would say and what everyone in the audience could say, you could say, with an absolute certainty that's relevant here. I am an experience. You are an experience. We are exchanging our experience right now. Everyone that is tuned in, that is listening to this, is experiencing our experience. The only thing that I am is an experience. If tomorrow I have lost all of my memory, then I have lost all that I am, that experience. If I opt to become the experience, the verb, as opposed to the noun, Eldon Taylor, who lives in Spokane, who drives an excursion. If I choose instead to be the verb, then everything in my context changes. And by that I mean now I am capable of being in the experience at the time of the experience and fully expressing the experience without a past or a future. And that's what's involved in being fully in the present. Now, if I'm fully in the present, it is not necessary for me to participate as a herd animal anymore. What I wear, how I dress, etc., is no longer important. That's all noun stuff. Well, I'm not going to find myself being moved with the whim and the will of every little event that comes along. I'm not going to, you know, see, I change my hairstyle because there's a new trend. I'm not necessarily going to buy thinner ties because my older ones are wider. Indeed, I'm going to pay less and less attention to that and more attention to the quality of my experience. I'm going to be cultivating these experiences. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and I know you know this, Wendy, when it's all said and done, and you transcend from this side to the other, and the evidence is pretty overwhelming that we do, personal consciousness does survive. So, you know, when my personal consciousness survives, passes over, rises up, if you will, I like that metaphor, I'm not going to take anything with me that I own. I'm not taking my possessions. I'm not taking trophies. I'm not taking awards. I'm not taking diplomas. I'm not taking, you know, monies. The only thing I can possibly take is those experiences. So isn't that what I should be investing in? I should be, who am I, finding that out, and investing in the experience of being that. Does that make sense to you, Wendy?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, can I come back at you with who I am?
Please.
I am beyond anything that can be defined.
I accept that.
So if I do that, then the definition is irrelevant. No matter what kind of word, language, explanation goes with it, it won't apply. And I think once we get into that kind of thinking, evaluation, exploration, we open ourselves to the imagination of what we might become if we got outside of our limitations and our definitions and our linear programming. And your book addresses that, the challenge of self-realization. What if is exactly what that's about.
And I agree with you, Wendy. When we look at our quintessential self, it is beyond the nature of definitions, you know, as is whatever else, you know, what we tend to think of as the grand organizing designer or God, beyond our definitions, you know. And yet at the same time, we come back and here in the flesh, we allow definitions to control us. And definitions, if you can control the definition, Wendy, you can control the argument, period, end of quotation. And people just, you know, they pay too little attention to that. They, you know, not to go to politics, but do you remember the National Security Domestic Extremism Dictionary that Janet Napolitano rolled out? I mean,
No, but I had a tough time trying to say her name when she first got elected. I was in Arizona at the time, and it was train wreck every time I try to pronounce it.
Well, this dictionary, you know, goes out to all law enforcement agencies in the country and is designed to be a forewarning, you know, of who is potentially an extremist that should be watched for national security reasons. Now, this dictionary, it defined very clearly right-to-life supporters as potential extremists, Second Amendment supporters, members of the NRA, say, National Rifle Association, as extremists, returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, it was because of the returning vets that enough attention and press was brought to this that Napolitano called the dictionary back and said, oh, this was a mistake. But it came right after the election of a liberal president, and these were liberal views, and they marginalized what you can think of as the conservative opposition. And you see, people don't, and I'm not supporting either side here, because I can come and tell you about a conservative attempt to marginalize the liberals. What I'm really saying is that people pay too little attention to how these definitions are deliberately employed to marginalize others, unless it's when they marginalize ourselves. And so when we're out there trying to fit in, And those that we're not fitting in with aren't willing to accept us. How will they marginalize us? They will begin to degrade us by way of representation in definitions. Children will just call it name-calling.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's basically labeling. What you're doing is guilt by association, and then it's easier to put a bias or a negative on a group of people than it is when you have to look at them as an individual and just say, well, that group, blah, blah, blah. But then when you deal with a person, say, well, you're nothing like the group. My gosh, you're actually a good person. If you put it to animals and you say, well, pit bulls are bad, but my, I have the best pit bull on the planet. And you realize all of these labels are, there is an agenda and there is a reason for assigning people, animals, everything into a certain group. And you have to look beyond that and say, why? What is happening here, and what are we being spoon-fed? What is the purpose of this? And sometimes it's just because it's too complicated to think about the individual. And one, it's easier to say, well, this group is this, and then you've done your thinking, and you move on to the next topic. And we do that right all the time without thinking.
That's right. And it's all done, as you point out, to shortcut thinking. You know, to shortcut thinking. Psychologists look at this today, and we just simply refer to it as adaptive unconscious, the automatic processes. You know, people drive down the highway, everybody's experienced this. Maybe they drive 20 miles, and suddenly there's their exit on the freeway. Oh, geez, there's my exit. And they put on their turn signal and move to the exit and realize, you know, I've been driving, and I'm safe. Everything has been safe, but I don't remember what, you know, I don't remember any of the road. That's automatic. So much of our lives are lived on automatic that the more those people that want to control our thoughts, those people that want to sell us a soundbite, and if you think about it, who does that include? Everyone in the media wants to own a bit of our thoughts. I mean, maybe it's a product that they want us thinking of. Maybe it's a plank and a platform of a political party they want us supporting. Maybe it's a proposition, a tax referendum they want us to. When you think about it, you know, all of this mediaocracy, that we are consuming on a daily basis is attempting to own our thoughts, which is why, you know, I simply think of much of the human condition as living in a falsophrenic state, false to themselves and frenically in pursuit of whatever belief system, whatever idea, whatever product is that they just consumed. You know, and a lot of people don't seem to understand that. I saw a recent poll. This is just one media, one form of media. This poll was done by the A.C. Nielsen Company, and it indicated that the average American watches 3 hours and 46 minutes of TV each day. And that's more than 52 days of nonstop TV watching in a year. By the age of 65, the average American will have spent nearly 9 years glued to the tube. Now, if you contrast that to this, parents, on average, spend 38 and a half minutes a week, not a day, this is minutes, a half hour in a week in meaningful conversation with their children. So you spend a half hour in meaningful conversation guiding our children, and yet we'll spend 52 days of nonstop TV in a year, nine years by the age we're 65. Now, you sit down in front of the television set, and what happens? Will you go into alpha? We've known that for a long time. Alpha's what? It's that stage that we think of as hypnotic. You know, it is a brainwave state, a slowed brainwave state. So now you're in hypnosis in front of that TV. And the fact is you're going to go in under 3 minutes. So you're in alpha. You're in front of that television set. Well, what then happens? Well, you know, parts of the brain just literally change in their functions. What happens is we see a crossover from the left to the right hemisphere and a surge of the body's natural opiates, endorphins, which include the beta endorphins and enkephalines. Now, you know, these neurochemicals are structurally identical to opium and its derivatives. So, you know, what happens is obviously we're filling our system with what is a very habit-forming, very addictive kind of natural opiates. Now, in that process, in this altered state, this very addictive altered state, spaced out, here comes the information. And the information may be designed to sell us the gombu, sickness, because if we don't get sick, you know, I mean, it's like this. I won't buy a life jacket unless you convince me I'm going to drown. So I have to build some anxiety in you, and that is a goal. That is an overt goal in almost all advertising, whether it is a political view, you know, and just think about what's going on right now politically, Medicare. You know, are we going to sell this on fear? One side's going to sell it on fear the country's going bankrupt. The other side's going to sell their position on fear that how can you rob the elderly people? These poor people are going to die in the streets. I mean, this is all coming designed to build anxiety. And the problem with this anxiety is twofold. First of all, it not only motivates us, and I'll come back to that, but second of all, Zimbardo has identified that in his research, they found that pathological symptoms may develop in up to one-third of normal participants in the rational process if they're trying to make sense of unexplained sources of arousal. Well, we're in this passive hypnotic state in front of the television having this arousal brought on by overt and subliminal information, and that leads to pathology in a third of the audience. And then we look and say, where's the civility in our world? Well, you know, people may say, hey, look, you know, all of this, I'm exempt from this, but and I don't, I just simply don't accept it. You know, where is the data? Well, let me give you a straight, linear in, linear out example of selling sickness from television. Not long ago, a restless leg syndrome commercial appeared everywhere throughout the world. It defined what restless leg was, the symptoms very vague. Now, there are some people that genuinely have restless leg syndrome, and I'm not demeaning that at all. What I do want to explore is this, the effect of this advertisement. So the advertisement, you know, appears and it runs every night multiple times on all the networks and around the world, really, but particularly in the Western world. If you look at the data, restless leg syndrome was a rare occurrence, rarely reported, influencing or affecting very few people. The commercial rolled out, and suddenly there is an exponential increase in the reports of restless leg syndrome. If you were to create a graph, you would have a baseline right down at the bottom of the paper, the bottom axis, and then a straight line going toward the top axis. Okay? Now, the patent on the drug expired. The pharmaceutical company pulled the commercial. And what happened? It fell right back to the baseline. There is an exact correlation. The commercials here, the reported incidents, the medication used, the commercial disappears, the medication disappears, the incidents disappear. Linear in, linear out. Now, just think of it this way. If you went to your hypnotist, before he brought you up out of trance, they said to you, now you're going to get sick. And when you do, I want you to come back here because I'll cure you. You'll pay me again to do that. You come back here and I'll take care of it. We would think of that as being licentious, amoral, unethical, perhaps even criminal.
Yes. Yes.
But we don't in the context of the media. You know, does that make any sense to you, Wendy?
I am so glad you brought this up. I have this very issue with a lot of the health things because it's that anxiety factor. And they say so-and-so would have been so much better if they had only had this happen. Instead, these are the symptoms they had, and they succumbed. Instead of saying, because so-and-so was ahead of the curve and knew what to look for, so-and-so is healthy. They don't do that. They do it backwards because they have to have that, oh my gosh, that fear factor for people to take action. In the meantime, what they are doing is so incredibly successfully subliminating and putting that information in there to program somebody to have that response and then need their product. It's brilliant, it's effective, and it happens 24/7, but very few people are really connected to the fact they are being programmed to be sick instead of to be healthy, because there's a huge investment by lots of very, very highly successful and profitable companies that keep this going. And we are part of the program if we participate. I'm so glad you brought it up, Eldon.
We consume it, and you made the point. It's 24/7, and you got to say, well, now look, if you know people listening to this show, for example, you can go away, and you can check all the facts, the figures, and the information, the ideas that Wendy and I are sharing, and then you can make a choice. You know, I'm going to go back to my television set because, after all, it does feel good, and I have these series, these TV programs that I like to watch. Or not. You can, you know, choose to tune into inspirational radio, or to turn on your, select a DVD, watch an educational, but you're going to make a choice. And now the real question comes. What amazes me, Wendy, is you can put it all on the table, and people will say, oh, well, that all makes sense. I understand that. And yet they'll go on doing the same thing over and over again. You know, Kurt Vonnegut said, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful what we pretend, you know?
Yeah, that's the imagination. It's the imagination. It's powerful, and that's what we have as an asset. It can be an asset, and when you're willing to start addressing the fact that you are creating these, we are creating our reality, we can make choices. It's just, you know, there's that fall back into letting the autopilot kick back in. And right now, like, if you are listening and you are curious about doing this, with the book What If, that challenge of self-realization, it's a workbook. You can go through and see what Eldon's talking about and disengage yourself from that, the matrix that we are looking at that says this is reality, and you find a whole different world out there when you engage that creative process and let your imagination say, I can't change this. Eldon,
all I can say is that is very well said.
I appreciate your time. I think you are doing a fabulous service getting people some real good content to help them shift some of the ways that they are working their own mind programming, and look for ways out and look for, you know, tools and new ideas, new frames of reference to start a different way of seeing reality and being a co-creator instead of just a passive creator. Does that make sense?
Well, I appreciate that, Wendy. I appreciate you and the opportunity to share with you and your audience as well.
And if you're listening again, go online, check out Eldon's website, eldontaylor.com. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio.